Revelation chapter 4. After this, I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne stood in heaven, with one seated on the throne. And he who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. And round the throne was a rainbow that had the appearance of an emerald. Round the throne were 24 thrones, and seated on the thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments with golden crowns on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and before the throne were burning seven torches of fire, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal. And round the throne, on each side of the throne, are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with the face of a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle in flight. And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and within. And day and night they never cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honour and thanks to him who is seated on the throne, who lives for ever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who is seated on the throne, and worship him who lives for ever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, saying, "Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honour and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created." This is the word of the Lord.
Revelation 4, where John is given this tremendous vision of heaven, in which we see God's will being done. And it's a great vision. It's a glorious vision that's given to John. Of course, through John, it's given to us. So we can also enter this vision and see it and marvel at it. Because when the voice of Jesus speaking like a trumpet says, "Come up here and I'll show you what must take place," Jesus, through John, is speaking to us. So we're being invited to come up into heaven to see what must take place. Now the question is, why is this happening? Let's remember that John was the island of Patmos. That was a Roman penal colony. It's where the Romans sent their criminals, their dissidents, their revolutionaries, to work themselves to death in the mines on Patmos. And John was sent there because he was a prominent Christian. And Christians back then were regarded as strange, regarded as extreme, regarded as those who were trying to turn the world upside down by not worshipping the emperor. They're regarded as rather strange people who tried to practice sexual restraint in the middle of the pagan empire, and so they were just regarded as totally and completely undesirable. John himself tells us that he was in the tribulation and in the patient endurance, which meant that he was a pilgrim in a barren land and had not yet arrived at glory. Not only that, he's just been given a vision of the seven churches of Asia. The seven churches, of course, well, you know them, the Thyatira, Laodicea, but the seven represents completeness. So those seven churches represent the complete church, the whole church, from the ascension of Jesus Christ of Nazareth to now and from now to the second coming. It's the church throughout the world. And John sees that these churches, like all churches everywhere, are troubled by heresy, false teaching, immorality, pride, half-heartedness, and they're all lukewarm. So he sees the church compromised and weak. In short, he sees this great cosmic struggle taking place between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And so he sees martyrdom, he sees violence, persecution, bloodshed, and drawn swords. And he's in trouble. He is in trouble. He's alone, he's separated from his church, he's away from Ephesus. Even now, even then, false teachers were entering the church. And he's cut off from his family, he's cut off from his friends, he's being worked to death, and he's in tribulation. Now, you also may be in some kind of tribulation. I don't think any of you are going to be sent to a penal colony tomorrow. But we all in this life suffer tribulation. The momentary afflictions and light afflictions compared to what John was going through, but we will all go through tribulation. Our sorrows in this world are real. Loved ones die. I buried my father last week. You feel diminished. You feel smaller. That's what death of friends and relatives does to us. It will do it to you too. Paul tells us that we must suffer many tribulations before we can enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus suffered many things. He suffered and then he entered glory. Now it's in this context, of course, that John is given this vision of heaven. Now of course many people scoff at this. They scoff at the idea of heaven. They say this is ridiculous. John is a slave and working in a mine. He is a prisoner of a vain, cruel emperor. What is all these visions of heaven? What's the point of being given a vision of heaven when you suffer on earth? Just stop back, step back for a minute and think about the assumption of that worldview. What that worldview assumes is that this world is the ultimate reality. It assumes that this world is the world that really matters, that it's in the cities, the great cities of the world, of London, Paris, Washington, Beijing, with its prime ministers and presidents and kings and governors. It assumes that it is this world where real power lies. What this vision of heaven is telling us is, please, please, don't be so parochial. For this world is not ultimate. Heaven is ultimate. You know, I love those films where you see men and women and they're eating, drinking, marrying and being given a marriage. And then all of a sudden at the end of the film, what you realize is that their world in which they lived was really a tiny world. An insignificant world. Don't know if any of you are watching War and Peace. But you get that impression in that film. You see the lives of the Russian aristocracy. And it's a magnificent picture of life in Russia. But all the while, I don't know if you get this, there's a sense of foreboding. Because you think, you get the impression that this magnificent world of czars and nobility, and it's all about to be swept away. Because beyond that world, beyond Russia, there is another throne at work. And those powers are about to knock Russia out into the cold. And this is what John sees when he looks up into heaven. He realizes that the world in which he is living is really, really insignificant. It is like Isaiah says that the kingdoms of this world are like a drop in a bucket. It's like dust on a scales. Hardly registers. And so when John hears this voice that comes, says, come up here, he's going to enter into a world that's going to relativize this world, and that's going to also relativize his sufferings, and they're not going to seem as great as he thought they were. So we're going to look at this. We're going to look at the throne. That's the first thing he sees, so that's really significant. We're going to look at this throne. We're going to look at four worshipping creatures. What are they? And then we're going to listen or look at that voice. What is that voice? So let's start with the throne. The first thing he sees. And what he sees, of course, is that the power that's emanating from this throne is absolutely immense. That's what he understands, that this is the throne at the center of the universe. But that's not really what's important. What's important is what that throne signifies. And I think that's why it's so relevant to us. Let me explain. We live, I think, in one of the most individualistic, fragmented cultures that the world has ever seen. I think that's true to say. I don't think there's been as fragmented or as individualistic a world as the one we live in today. What does that mean? Well, you know, I've referred to War and Peace already. Are you guys watching it? I can't wait to get back. 9 o'clock, I'll be there watching War and Peace. And what you have in this world, I think that's why Downton Abbey appeals to people, actually. Because what you have in this world is that everybody in that world knew their place. You had the czar at the top, and then you had the nobility, and then the middle classes, and the merchants, the professionals, and the working classes, and the factory workers, the soldiers, and the peasants underneath. It was a world that was ordered. And everybody was ordered around the throne of the czar. That's how the whole thing worked. And what that meant is, in that culture, everybody knew where they belonged. Everybody knew where they were. Everybody knew how they related to everybody else. It was a whole civilization. And of course that meant, of course, there are great inequalities, of course, we know that. But what that did give people is a sense of belonging to this vast civilization. Of being bound together, and they related to each other through the institutions of the nobility, or the church, or the family, or the tribe, or the subject of the monarch. It was united society. Downton Abbey was like that, and that meant that relations were significant. You could relate to people easily. It wasn't a culture in which people were lonely. Did you know that now in Western Britain has been called the loneliness capital of Europe? Because now we're a society that's adrift. And many people actually don't know where they fit in anymore. And men and women are saying, you know, I don't want to be restrained. I don't want to belong to this ordered society. I want to find my own meaning. Our greatest preacher and his the greatest sermon, I mean, that's a sermon that David Bowie preached, wasn't it? David Bowie preached that you could change all the time. You didn't have to belong to an ordered society. You could create your own thrones. One day it could be the throne of punk rock, the next day a glam rocker, always slipping and sliding, dipping and diving, asexual, hypersexual, homosexual, transgressive. That was his sermon. That was what he preached. He said, listen to this, David Bauer, he said, you don't have to stay where you are. You don't have to stay who you are with. You don't have to stay where you are. You don't have to stay who you are with. That's a lonely culture. always changing, never fitting in. Last week, as you know, I went to Italy. Got the chance to go to Orvieto. I don't know if you've been to Orvieto. There's this magnificent cathedral. I mean, I think it's greater than St. Peter's. It's glorious. Not as big, but glorious. And when you go up to the cathedral, Nicole and I went up to the cathedral doors and we were looking very closely at it. There's all this pieces of glass, different colors, different shapes. Thousands upon thousands of them, all cut out by hand, all stuck together. But it's only when you step back, you see where it fits in. Where that one individual piece of glass fitted into the whole edifice of this magnificent cathedral. Up close, you can't see the whole. Step back and you see where all fits in. Now when John is taken up into the throne room of heaven, he sees how the whole universe fits together. As I said, it's rather like, I think, being at the control tower of Heathrow Airport. I mean, if you go to Heathrow Airport, go to a major airport, you see chaos on the ground, don't you? Planes taxiing, planes coming back, planes taking off. You see bags, you see stewardesses, you see passport control. It looks like chaos. But when you go to the control tower, everything is, I imagine, I've never been, but I've seen it on film. I imagine you got, well, in the film I saw about Heathrow Airport, okay. I think it was very quiet. Very quiet. Calm words were spoken. Things happened. A man spoke. Airplanes came down. Another man spoke. Airplanes took off. All ordered. Harmony. And all of a sudden, as John's taken up into this control tower, he understands what he's going through, that all the loneliness and all the persecution, all the difficulties and the tribulations of this life have a purpose. Now you can't see it, just as I can't see, look in the airplanes at Heathrow Airport, I can't see the plan, but there is a plan. Paul tells us in Ephesians that God has purposed to bring all things in heaven and earth together under one head, even Christ. And God's going to bring all things together. Why? Because in this world, all things have split apart. That's what happened. That happened at the dawn of creation. When men and women said, we do not want to live under the throne and the authority of God. We don't want to live in communion and fellowship with God. We want to create our own thrones and have our own crowns on our own heads. And so men and women fell apart. Society fell apart. Men and women became aliens and strangers to each other and to God. The man said, this woman you gave me. Eve said, the serpent. And there was all this blame and blame shifting. But now John sees everything coming back together. Now if you know that and you're suffering, what will that give you? If you don't know it, I guess you despair. If you do know it, and you're suffering, and on the island of Patmos, and working in a mine, or about to be thrown to the lions tomorrow, shall I tell you what that will give you? It will give you fortitude. It will give you strength. And it will give you a great, great sense of peace. So that's what he saw, the throne. The second thing he saw were these four worshipping creatures. Now, what are these? He sees four beasts, a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. Four. What are they? Well, all sorts of theories have been advanced. So there are four gospels. Oh, they must be, you know, four gospels. Others have said it represents Jesus in his incarnation, death, resurrection, ascension. Four. I think people just think of four and stick it on there. Other people say the four ancient churches of Jerusalem, Constantinople, Antioch, and Alexandria. Now, the theories go on and on and on and on, as you can imagine. I just try and keep things real simple, as you know. So I just look four creatures. This represents the whole of creation. You've got the lion as the king of all the wild animals. You've got the ox, the most powerful of domesticated animals. You've got humanity represented in man's face, and the eagle representing creatures that fly. So it's the whole of the creation. And the whole of the creation now in this vision is centered around the throne, and they're all worshiping. The whole of the creation is worshiping. Do you know that the creation does that now? The whole of creation is worshiping God. In Psalm 66, the psalmist says, "All the earth worships you and sing praises to you." They sing praises to your name. The whole earth is worshiping God. All the created order. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky proclaims his handiwork." That's what nature's doing. Paul tells us in Romans that the creation perceives and understands God's invisible qualities. His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived, listen to this, in all things that have been made. And that's, you see, why, if you look at creation, that's why it's so glorious. That's why at times when you look at a mountain range, or you look at the roaring sea, or a magnificent sunset, you're just blown away. In fact, C.S. Lewis went so far as to say, none of us could understand what the word glory meant if we had never seen a sunset. Seeing a sunset tells you what glory means. You see it and you think, yes, that's glorious, that's magnificent, that's awesome. And why is creation so magnificent? Creation is so magnificent because creation is obeying the laws of its own nature. That's why it's so magnificent. That's why it's so glorious. Because nature is always true to herself. She obeys her own laws. And so the sun always rises and always sets. The moon waxes and wanes. The wildebeest on the African plains always go north, and the young lions are fed. And so steady and so reliable and so dependable is the creation that mankind can track vast and huge oceans by the light of a star. The sun never says, "Oh, today I'm not going to rise." The moon never says, "Today I'm not going to wax and wane." The whales at the turn of the seasons always migrate north. They never say, "No, not this year." They do it. The whole of creation, with one exception. Mankind, endued with a dignity and honor of being made in the image of God, has asserted his independence. The only creature in the whole of the creation to do so, he stamped his little foot and he said, "I'm not going to orbit my life around the throne. I'm going to establish my own throne." I don't know if you know that poem by that Roman Catholic poet, Gerald Manley Hopkins. In his poem, God's Grandeur, he writes, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed." But then he says, "Why do men then not now wreak his rod?" If that's what creation does, why doesn't mankind live in harmony with the glory of God? With God's discipline, with his rod, with his order. Nature does, he says, and is charged with the glory of God. But he says, man has made a god, not of God, but a god of money, which is not the real God. It is a false god. And so now he is as ugly as his god. This is Gerald Manley Hopkins. Now he has become as ugly as the god he worships. Now all is seared with trade, bleared and smeared with oil, with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. But here in the throne room of heaven, man once more takes his place in the proper order of creation. And look at that. Look at the radical individuality of the ox, the eagle, the man, and the lion. All separate, all unique. Like those pieces of glass on Orvieto Cathedral. All separate, all unique, yet working in a perfect harmony. And they're crying out, holy, holy, holy. Because they're all worshiping. Which is what, by the way, what you are made to do. You are made to worship. We were made to give our lives over to something or to someone greater and bigger than ourselves. We often give our lives to things that will never cause us to cry out, holy, holy, holy. Instead, we give ourselves over to things that will destroy us, that will kill us. But here John is saying, look, these creatures are crying out, holy, holy, holy. Because the delight and joy that they are experiencing will never, ever run out. Indeed, these creatures around the throne of God will never be able to fully plumb the breadth or height or length or depth of the glory of God. Sounds good. Sounds good, doesn't it? How do we get it? I'll finish with this. The voice. That's how John begins. He begins his whole book, the Revelation, because he's heard a voice. A voice, as it were, of a trumpet, which said, come up here. And he hears his voice again now. Heard it back in Revelation 1, verse 18, I think. He hears it again now, this voice. And it's the voice, of course, of Jesus. That's calling John. It is Jesus' voice that's calling John to come up into heaven to see visions of God. And you say, well, okay, what's the significance of that? The significance of that is simply this. It is Jesus' voice that is calling John, because it's only through Christ and his word that we can have access to God and heaven. Without the voice of Jesus, there would be no door opened in heaven. We would not have visions of God. You would not have fortitude or strength or patience in time of suffering. You'd have none of those things if it wasn't for the voice. And of course, this voice of Jesus, as you start to read the Bible, it's there from the very beginning. As he comes after Adam, he says, Adam, where are you? It's a voice in the book of Proverbs where Jesus personified cries out in the market squares and says, unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is towards the sons of men. This voice is going out to you this evening. It's going out to the whole world. It's this voice of Jesus that's called John. It's this voice of Jesus that is calling you. It's a voice like a trumpet. It's a voice that called Noah to build the ark. It's a voice that called Abraham out of Ur. It's a voice that called his people out of slavery in Egypt. It is the same voice that called Moses to ascend Mount Sinai. It is the same voice that called Ezekiel, who saw heaven opened. It is the same voice that Isaiah heard in the year that King Uzziah died, so that he saw a throne that was high and lifted up. It is the same voice that called Matthew and James and John to come and follow him. And it is the same voice that is also anxiously calling you and saying, come up here and I will show you things which must be. Amen.